absolutely no sense, Ted. But see, there are a lot of things in their story that make no sense.
Yeah.
And the issues become this. How many people in the Christian right community have even been brought up to speed on these? Well, it's a con job, is what it is. I mean,
well,
we're being conned.
Yeah, I know. It's a tremendous con job. But just backtracking just a little bit, I don't think anybody really knows what a pure Semite really is. I mean, we've got 3,000-4,000 years ago that have passed. And I don't think there is a pure Semite.
Well, that's right. So all the more reason to make this. Okay, am I being anti-Jewish, or am I being anti-Hebrew, or am I being anti-Israeli? Possibly those would be more apropos. But to say I'm anti-Semitic when half the blood of course, you just stated, half the blood of Ishmael was Semitic.
Yeah.
Does that encompass the Arabs?
I think if you wanted to be perfectly accurate, you could say that if you denigrated a Sephardic Oriental Jew who had a relatively high level of Semitic blood in him, then that term would have some meaning to it. But certainly not against the Ashkenazi aliens, these Khazars who have come in and basically taken over the whole thing. Now, you know, it's really interesting that, in my opinion, rather than this whole Khazar infusion subverting the argument that God has an unfinished business with the Jewish people, I believe it confirms these prophecies out of Deuteronomy that I have read, and that is that in the long trajectory of time over the millennia, what God is saying is that the relatively pure Sephardim, whatever you want to call them, the true Jews, the true descendants of Judah, will be kind of encapsulated within this great mass and the energies and the revolutionary fervor of the Khazar alien majority that is surrounding them. And the Khazars are basically providing a good deal, if not most, of the power and the trajectory of the Jewish messianic ambitions for world control.
Now let's go to another subject here that has been very powerful in the extreme when I've discussed it with almost anyone. We did our research, Ted. You know, you talked to me 6 months ago. Did I know this stuff 6 months ago, Ted?
Well, I think you were wanting to concentrate on political realities pretty much of the present.
Well, I have, and the fact is, I've come up to speed quickly on these different things behind the scenes here. One of the things that I know has happened is we've got a group called Lubavitch, the Shabbat Lubavitch. And now, of course, as soon as I brought their name forward in my discussions, I was off the radio in a New York second.
Yes.
Now, here's the thing that I've discovered, and you've done some reading at my urgings to go to their website, that the Lubavitch have, over time, said that they were privy to the Messiah in their midst, and that included this man named Menachem Shearson.
Uh-huh.
Now, Menachem Shearson died some years ago, and it had been the tradition up until recently to immediately name another chief rabbi of the Lubavitch.
Uh-huh.
This time, they did not.
Yes.
Instead, what they did in their Manchester headquarters and in their New York headquarters, declare that the Moish was imminent.
Uh-huh.
That their Messiah was imminent. They put it up in big banners across their different locations throughout Britain and America and also in Germany.
Uh-huh.
Now, what this means to us is that, if I'm being accurate here, is that these people believe that the Messiah has returned. Now, why is that important? I brought you the evidence as well that we have Lubavitch rabbis working within the White House under Ari Fleischer and under Chertoff's father was a rabbi from within this sect, as well as Dov Zolkheim.
Yeah.
And we also see them very prevalent in the Likud party in Israel.
Yes, absolutely.
So now what we've got here is we've got the Shabbat Lubavitch, and I explained to you, and I don't know if you've confirmed this or not, but they are the spiritual arm of this powerful financial empire we call Rothschild, Warburg, Goldman, Kahn, across the different parts of the world, including our media control from Sumner Redstone, who's a crypto Jew, and many others. And what we find here is that they've got something afoot to reinstall at the end of this next phase somebody in Jerusalem as their Messiah and to reestablish the Temple Mount. And this is the only thing we could glean. There was the only thing that made sense, and it's the only reason why they would be consolidating their power from the Euphrates all the way over to the Nile. And it seems to me we're in the last days of what these people believe is their Messiah's coming.
Well, I think in order to understand exactly what you're talking about, as late as these banners at the synagogue in Manchester, we have to go all the way back practically to the time of Christ. Now, of course, I believe Christ was the Messiah, the great husband of Israel, the author of the whole thing, the creator of the whole universe. In fact, he came down in human form, and he was rejected by his own and actually crucified. I believe that the Jews had their Messiah, but they delivered him over to Pontius Pilate and so on, and screamed, "Let his blood be upon us and on our children forever." But this recurrent attempt to produce a Messiah punctuates Jewish history throughout the last several thousand years. And the first big attempt was the revolt of Bar Kochba. You see, Titus destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, but he didn't really drive all Jews out of the region. There was still an awful lot of Jewish activism and revolutionary zealot activity going on, which continued at Masada and afterwards and so on. The Jews were determined that, having crucified Christ, they were going to have another Messiah. And around 130 A.D., another Messiah came on the scene, and the great rabbis, such as Rabbi Akiba, through Kabbalistic occultry, determined that he was the true Messiah. And Bar Kochba created a tremendous revolt throughout the whole Mediterranean, all the way down to Africa, Palestine, Asia Minor, and so on. It was a big thing. And, in fact, Edward Gibbon, in his History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, describes how these revolutionary forces in this great rebellion, they slaughtered thousands, tens of thousands of Gentiles in Cyprus and Cyrene and Egypt and so on.
Who did? The Jewish community?
What's that?
Who did it? Who slaughtered them? The Jews?
The Jews did. The Jews, in the beginning of the 2nd century A.D., according to Gibbon, and he's quoting the Roman historian Cassio Dio Cucianus. That's book 68 of Cassio's Cassio Dio's history. Anyway, what happened was the Romans under Hadrian reacted against this attempt to establish a new Messiah. They came to Palestine and they really, really cleaned up. They profaned the whole area. They gave a new name to Jerusalem and Palestine. They called it Aulus Capitolina. They really were sick and tired of the Jews, and so they banished all the Jews from Palestine at that time. Now, when the Khazars came in, they were very, as Rafik so eloquently stated in last week's broadcast, they were very interested in this revolutionary aspect of the Kabbalah, the Messiah, and so on. And I privately think they probably had a lot of propaganda going there, that they were really the lost 10 tribes of Israel, which were rediscovered in the process of time. There was some kind of mechanism there, a yeast going in Khazaria, to really convince them that they were the separated.
Well, you also have to understand, too, there was a king demanding they change, and you know what happened when Henry VIII said that there's no more Catholicism.
Sure, but I would, you know, you see the 10 tribes were dispersed up into Assyria, up into that area,
mm-hmm.
just south of that, and it wouldn't take very much imagination to convince yourself that you were actually the 10 tribes that migrated up there, and you really were descendants of Abraham. Of course, they weren't. Their own history shows, as Rafik said, 2,000 years of Hittite and Hunnish ancestry and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what I'm saying is this Kabbalistic ferment really, really became very, very much accepted among the Khazarians, And as he was pointing out so well, under the Lurianic Kabbalah,
yes,
Isaac Luria created around the middle of the 16th century, this ignited this kind of fanaticism and messianic revolutionary zeal, literally to take over the world.
Now, Lurian stuff came out of this guy Sabbatai Zevi's attempts to also claim that he was the Messiah.
Well, actually, Luria stimulated Sabbatai Zevi. Sabbatai Zevi didn't actually proclaim himself Messiah there in Smyrna in Asia Minor until 1666, and the Luria Kabbalah was created about a century earlier than that. Anyway, inherent in the Kabbalah, whatever kind of Kabbalah you want to read, and I've been to the Mantuan edition of the Zohar in the original Aramaic, which is contemporary with that, and had translations made out of it. Whatever it is, it's pretty hot stuff. In fact, even Hasidic Jews today don't allow their young men to even read it until they're about 40 years old. It's so volatile in its revolutionary, messianic ambitions and fervor and so on. Anyway, what happened was the Sabbataean revolt basically failed, as we saw last week, and yet there were all kinds of these sects, these Hasidic sects, springing up throughout Poland with their own Zadiks or Baal Shems, masters of the name, masters of the mysteries and jugglery and magic of Kabbalah and so on. And one of the main Jacob Frank does was he basically picked up after the death of Sabbatai Zevi and fundamental to this fanatical Kabbalistic theology is the idea that it doesn't matter. It simply doesn't matter if a great Zadik or Messiah has died, because there's a good chance he'll rise from the dead again. And they can raise him from the dead, even if they don't have an actual candidate for messiahship at that time. He can be raised from the dead. And so there in Poland, especially as we get toward the beginnings of the 18th century, anticipating the Great French Revolution and so on, we find these Hasidic Kabbalistic rabbis with tremendous wealth, tremendous followings, living in palatial splendor in Poland primarily, but also coming in to the capitals of Western Europe. We have Jacob Falk setting up residence in England with tremendous influence over people such as Weishaupt and so on, and the Bavarian Illuminati. And we also find Jacob Frank starting his sect of the Illuminati, the Zoharists, around 1755 in Germany. Coming out of Poland, we find Cagliostro coming out of Sicily, and Saint Germain coming out of Portugal. These wonder workers, these Jewish wonder workers, both from the Sephardic communities of the West and the Ashkenazi of the East, were descending on a great rendezvous in the first 50 years before the actual French Revolution.
Well, see, now this is absolutely correct, and they also, Ted, like I mentioned earlier, with their new Bohemian group in southern Bavaria that were also Sabbatian in their practices. In other words, practicing wife swapping and orgies.
Yeah.
They sent packing early in the 1710, 1730s, like that, several groups of men, including a man named Solomon Bush.
Yes.
Solomon Bush arrived, and he set up one of the first Masonic lodges of Bohemian roots under Weishaupt's tutelage and the direction of Frank.
Yes.
And he got his financing from the Rothschild fortune.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these people arrived in America. There were four of them initially to set up these lodges. And they became what's called crypto-Jews. Now, you understand what that term means from the Muranos in Spain.
Sure.
And from the Dolomites in Turkey when they had the Young Turks, as well as the crypto-Jews that actually enslaved the Russian people after 1917.
Yes.
So now we've got a situation in America where many of our most respected leaders, or I say respected, I should they should be condemned, but most respected in the sense that they're politically powerful, are in fact either in league with or actually crypto Jews. And this is one of the things that Eric and I have arrived at as a result of examining both the actions of this bohemian movement that was sent over. Now, why does this all make sense? I mean, there was never anything that unified me, Ted, when I looked at the whole picture. Uh-huh. I knew the Jews were controlling our media. I knew they controlled our finances. I knew they were buying off our politicians. But I didn't understand how the entire flow of history was being swayed in their favor.
Yeah.
This element that I'm discussing now was the real linchpin for me to know how they ended up taking America, just like they did with Russia. They did with, they repeated this same action over and over. Why? It was so successful.
Yeah.
Now, in the Spanish sense, when they talk about the Inquisition, it's always in negative terms. But what Isabella was doing, and with Ferdinand and Isabella were doing, were actually identifying crypto Jews in their midst and getting rid of them.
Well, you know, one of the things which I think I would need to clarify a little bit from what Rafik said in the previous broadcast was he was describing the so-called Sephardic Jews. In the first 1,000 years or so after Christ, that is the Jews of the West, as basically Torah observers and not into the Talmud and the Kabbalah.
Well, they weren't exclusively Talmudic. But see, the Khazars were almost exclusively Kabbalistic and Talmudic, and to the exclusion in many cases of the Torah. In other words, the Torah became a sub importance to them as opposed to Sephardis, who gave it a more elevated position within their understand from him.
That might be true, but the fact of the matter is that when the Pharisees, you see, that the tribe of Judah and Benjamin went to Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar in the 6th century BC, and most Jews stayed there, and Pharisaism flourished in Babylon. In fact, the Pharisees set up huge academies in Babylon, especially at Sura and Pumbedita, and literally they received petitions and questions and so on from Jews throughout the entire world, even from as far as Spain, going for the ultimate decisions, the ultimate definitive answers in Babylon. Now, what the Pharisees set up, even in the first and second centuries, was a total authority over Judaism, a total eclipsing of the powers of the Old Testament, the authority of the Old Testament, the authority of Moses, and that Pharisaic authority was clear across from Spain to clear to Babylon, and I think that Rafik was kind of going a little too far in saying that the Jews of Spain, the Jews of Italy, the Jews of North Africa, that is the so-called Sephardim, gave greatest authority to the law of Moses. Let me tell you, the law of Moses was on its way out even when Jesus was on the scene, where he told the Pharisees to their faces that they had overturned the law of God by their rabbinic oral law and traditions. And they had pretty much eclipsed the law of Moses even at that time. And so another thing I want to say, well, we have to remember this. I think we'd be a little unbalanced if we put all of our conspiracy in the Khazar eastern side, because there was a very strong movement of Kabbalah, Talmudism. You see the Jews in Italy, the Jews in Spain, the Jews in Germany, the Jews in Holland and so on were all Kabbalistic oriented. And in fact, Manasseh ben Israel was an arch Kabbalist rabbi who came over and basically wanted to buy up St. Paul's Cathedral from Oliver Cromwell. He wanted to get Cromwell thoroughly indebted to him and so on, and Cromwell did take money from him, but he was a Kabbalist even then. And we find, as we go back, we find that the so-called Sephardic, now let's just clarify Sephardic. Sephardic means Spanish. It means Spanish Jews. And that's a term of convenience. which is used to describe everything except Ashkenazi. The truth is, there were Italian Jews, there were Moroccan Jews, there were, as I say, Dutch Jews, there were English Jews, French Jews, all over the place, and we call them all Sephardic, but actually I would prefer just to use the term authentic Jews, because relatively speaking, they were descendants of the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, which were left after the northern 10 tribes had been dispersed by Sargon II in the 8th century B.C. These were the fathers of the modern Jewish race for all practical purposes as we know it now, the authentic Jews. And so what I'm saying here is that the authentic Jews throughout Western Europe were by no means mild or innocuous or without ambitions for world control or for the coming of their Messiah. They were Kabbalistic, they were wonder workers, they were usurers, they were merchants, they got strangleholds on kings and nations and had to regularly be expelled from nations such as England and France and Spain and so on. And they were a very potent force, and I would even go so far as to say that if the Khazars had not moved west into Germany and so on, they would still be a potent force of anti-Christianity in the world today. In fact, Martin Luther was so concerned about the anti-Christianity of the Jews in Germany at the beginning of the 16th century that he vowed that once his business with the Pope was dealt with and he'd taken care of that big problem, there was another big problem he said was looming on the horizon, and that was the ascendancy of Jews in Europe. And these were not basically Khazars. These were authentic Jews steeped in Pharisaism, steeped in the Kabbalah, which were permeating Europe at that time, and they had their own agenda. It was anti-Christian, Talmudic, Zoharistic, and all that kind of thing. So basically what we have to remember is that even though these wonder workers came from the East, such as Falk and Frank and so on, these Baal Shems from the East, nevertheless, there were people like Cagliostro and St. Germain who were coming from the West up to Germany to meet there, to converge and to penetrate into Masonic organizations and basically lay the foundation for the collapse of the French dynasty.
Now, I got a question for you now. We're going to move on now because this is already an hour's worth of our effort here, and I don't want to destroy the attention span of my audience. However, here's the interesting thing. For all accounts and all of my research, they've turned out to be one of the most hateful groups of people I have ever known in all of my life. And by hateful, what I mean is they take an opposite position to everything kind and good about other people and either use it against them or use it to their own advantage. I use it as a weakness rather than as a grace.
Uh-huh.
And this is, for me, the most aberrant of all things I have ever examined in my life. And yet they've turned the tables on societies around the world to have everyone think that they're the nice guys and we're the bad ones.
They're the victims.
How in the world did they get this done like that?
Yeah.
I don't get it, Ted.
Well, part of their strategy, you see, is to create a guilt complex in the other nations, particularly in Christianity. Now, they're the ones who should have the guilt complex because they were the ones who set the Sanhedrin in the book of Acts is recorded over and over again as sending out persecutors against the infant Christian church. It's they that should be guilty. They are the one who the Sanhedrin and the people screamed in Pilate's ears, "Crucify him, crucify him." But this whole idea of a guilt complex or collective guilt is a very clever strategy which they have used, especially during this last century. You know, if anyone seems to have behaved improperly through time, then it's not just the people in antiquity who are guilty, it is the descendants of those people. And therefore, the Germans today are collectively guilty for what Hitler did and must support the State of Israel in perpetuity. Or the Christians in the South are perpetually guilty for what the slave master forebears did to the blacks in our nation's past.
Well, I've got to tell you something. We've uncovered new evidence that that many, 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 many billions of dollars from Jewish bankers went to support and prop up the Hitler regime,
uh-huh.
and that many of his top leaders were actually Jewish,
yeah.
including Goebbels. Now listen, 100 of his top SS men were actually 100% Jewish.
Oh my.
Now this is evidence that we've uncovered. The fact is that Hitler's regime was riddled with Judaism, and many believe that Hitler himself had one-quartered Jewish blood in him.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you take a look at these facts, and you understand that Stalin was half-Jewish, and you take a look at Khrushchev and all of this, and I mean, you go on through our history of this deception going on and on, and I say to myself, when are we as a group of threatened people going to wake up to these facts and start looking at it rationally?
Uh-huh.
Now, I always caveat these kinds of accusations with the fact that many, many Jews, and I'd say right now half of the Jewish community are not even followers of their own religion.
Uh-huh.
So they're Jewish by heritage, but certainly not by their actions. And I have in my camp many, many people. I got the Cohen family from my hometown and the Brodskys, and there's many of them. And they were not these kinds of people, Ted, and they're still not. I've seen them since. I know what they're doing. They're not this kind of group.
Well, this is why I use the term evil Jewish leaders. If we look through the history of the Jews, clear back to the Hebrew prophets, we find the prophets excoriating the evil Jewish leaders. And in the book of Ezekiel, God causes Ezekiel in a vision to dig through this whited wall, and he finds inside of the Sanhedrin images of tremendous abomination and apostasy and so on. And this theme that comes from the Hebrew prophets is that these evil Jewish leaders have perennially led the flock of Israel astray. And we find exactly that dynamic going on today, as Rafik said recently in one of his broadcasts. He said that even the Lubavitcher group was intended as a kind of a middle-of-the-road Orthodox Judaism, intended to bring in and seduce the flock of Israel into deeper and deeper into messianic world ambitions and so on. And so really, really what we have to do is we have to realize that the real impetus of the last century for Zionist expansion and Jewish domination of all elements of society has come from the false religious convictions and the romanticism of the evangelical church, which basically pervades Western society. This idea that Bible prophecies can be fulfilled by the Zionists right now through guns and tanks and concentration camps for the Arab dissenters and so on, these are misguided misinterpretations of the true biblical standard. The Bible again and again and again in the Law of Moses tells the Jews that if they do not obey God, if they do not exercise justice, mercy, and righteousness, even to the aliens and the Gentiles that dwell in the land, God will throw them out of the land. They'll be exiled, and they cannot ever come back in again until they give God that kind of obedience.
Well, so now what we've got today, and this is, and I'm going to call it an end to this particular interview at this point, Ted. But I want to say what we've got today is. Well, in the last 100 years, 100 million deaths directly attributed to this group. All you need to do, ladies and gentlemen, is listen to Benjamin Friedman's first-person accounts. First person, he was there. Or listen to Mr. Untermyer returning from Germany in 1933 and talking about how we're going to bring Germans to their knees and foment the kinds of discourse and discord that is going to breed hatred in the future. All to get an exodus of very entrenched Jews and cosmopolitan Jews to leave and populate Israel on the after this Balfour signing. And then take a look at what they did in Russia. It was almost a payback for the Tsar discovering their terrible crimes and actually telling them to get out of his country. Well, they said, yeah, we'll make you pay for that. 4,000 it took. That's all, Ted.
Yes.
4,000 Jews took over the Russians. They fleeced the country, built it for all its treasure, and then enslaved its people for 75 years.
Yes.
Now, these are the kinds of people we're dealing with here. They are monsters, They are monstrous, monstrous, monstrous evil people. And I can't even imagine how anybody could want to back a monster like this. I implore the listener who has ties to this, you must do your research. I beg of you to do research in the real world. I mean, look, if you do this research and put your finger on this stuff, you will shake with revulsion at what has happened on at the hands of these folks. Do you have any? You have an amen for that, Ted.
I certainly do. And whenever these people get out of line, whether it's imprisoning these Christians in Philadelphia, or they're putting a new hate bill in Congress, or the Book of Daniel, what we have to do is get up on our soapbox on the Internet primarily and let the whole world know in specific terms who these people are, their racial and spiritual agenda and ancestry. And I believe that's going to work to solve the problem, at least for the moment, as both evangelicals and the Jewish people can put pressure upon them.
Well, we are at a late hour, Ted. I want to remind you that they have a plan, and they are exercising all speed to bring this thing to fruition. And it has something to do with this Iranian mess, the Syrian mess, the stuff we're doing in Iraq. And I got to tell you something, they are really working toward this messianic goal, and I don't know how much time we have. There is very little time to waste. Yeah. And I urge everyone to become learned in these subjects so that you can become part of the solution and not be perpetrating or promoting or propagating the era of this historic discussion we had tonight.
Maybe I could just mention in closing that if people would like to learn more about my point of view, come to truthtellers.org. That's www.truthtellers.org. We have a wealth of information, articles, videos, and so on.
And you will also find a link on IamTheWitness.com to Ted's books and his website. It's at the bottom amongst my books, and you can just click on that, and it'll bring you over. So if you're surfing the I Am the Witness site, it has a direct and very large link right at the bottom. You can't miss it. It says Reverend Ted Pike, and it says Truth Tellers, and it has a little thing for his books and videos. It'll bring you right to his website. I want to thank you again, Ted, for moving the ball forward once again. We're going to do it again because this is not entertainment talk radio. This is not what this is about. This is about education and information. We are all at risk today, and I want everyone to know that I will keep this battle up as long as I'm breathing. One way or another, we have to breathe life into these truths so that we can all save ourselves from this horrendous and heinous group of people. Anyway, you Ted, you are a treasure in my book. You are somebody that I work hard to I work for your interest all the time. I mean, this is something we've done together so far, and it's worked to some degree. I don't think anyone has ever gotten this kind of traction on these facts, and I applaud you for your efforts, Ted.
Well, the feeling's mutual. Thank you so much, Daryl.
I'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Bye now.
That was my guest, Ted Pike, Reverend and researcher. And look, guys, we the people, it's us. We are the sovereigns. We have to exercise our sovereign right to both the truth and to justice. And I'm begging each of you who listen to this download to begin the battle of your own in taking our country and our world back. Until the next installment of the French Connection, which would be tomorrow, Tuesday, the 14th of February, my birthday, we're going to do, I don't even know who we'll have tomorrow, hopefully somebody very interesting. But in any case, have a great evening, and till tomorrow. Bye-bye.